Welcome to episode 90 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Having been asked by a number of people, and also really just meaning to do this for a while now for my own bat, I am going to start a two-part podcast to explain all the major steps in my digital workflow from shooting to printing and also sort of, you know, showing the images on the web, etc. Today I'm going to cover from capture to the end of my rating process when I have a final list of images that I'm going to take further in my workflow. This is effectively going to be an update of episode 12 when I originally described my digital workflow, and basically as everything in a workflow changes, as new tools become available and as personal preferences change, and also just because we learn new ideas and things, it's really necessary to just keep updating this. And I dare say that in a year's time, I'll be doing the same thing again. So for the sake of time, I'm not going to go into much detail about what I used to do in comparison to what I do now, unless it's really relevant. But I will mention briefly as necessary. I'm also going to start today from capture, as I'm thinking that, you know, this is really an important part of the overall workflow. Of course, there'd be no need for a workflow if there were no images, but I'm assuming that, you know, we're taking some kind of shot. But I think it's important that you know, we start to consider things at capture, so that we can set the stage for making things easier or just better quality later on. Not all of my ideas are going to be new or original, and not all of them will be of any interest to you or of use to you. If there are some things that you do like the sound of, though, you know, by all means, merge that into your own workflow. So from the offset, you have to decide how you're going to record the images to your memory card, assuming that you're shooting digital. The first thing that I do when I get a new camera is to set the color space to Adobe RGB. Usually the default will be sRGB, but this is only really appropriate when you only ever intend to view your images on a standard computer screen. Many high-end displays now actually support displaying images, the display of Adobe RGB as well. So this may not always be true, but generally that's the case. The web is still predominantly sRGB, so if you only ever intend to view your images on a computer screen, or you only want to publish them for the web, then you don't need to worry about this. If you want to print your images with the most colors available, with current technology that is, selecting Adobe RGB in the camera is advisable. There are other color spaces such as the Profoto RGB, and even if the best color space you can capture in is Adobe RGB, if you're going to play around with the colors in post-processing, then it might be worth investigating this. I'm currently considering doing so, but I've not yet made the switch. There are some things that you have to do later in your workflow with regards to color space, but we'll get to that later. The other thing I always do is shoot in RAW mode. So I know that many people are clinging to JPEG, and I myself did until a few years ago, mainly because using RAW used to be a pain. It took a long time to view images, you know, for images to actually appear on your screen or to sort of res in, even though you could see a fuzzy version to begin with. And you often sort of had to push them through separate processing procedures before you could even work with them. But all that is changing. Computers are getting faster, and the software to support the RAW shooter is now so good that it's absolutely not an issue. So all of the benefits of RAW come at very little cost in terms of additional effort or waiting, etc. Not only does RAW allow you to change settings like white balance in post-processing if you didn't get it right in the camera, You'll get better detail in your highlights and shadows, and basically anything that helps me to get the best quality final image possible is highly recommended. Most Canon users with a camera released since the 5D will know about picture styles. When I first did a review of the 5D in, appropriately, episode 5 of this podcast, I said that I didn't like the landscape picture style because it was too gaudy. But since then, I've learned how to control my colors better with some finer tuned exposure, and it really wasn't much longer after that episode when I realized that the extra punch that the landscape picture style gave my images was actually quite pleasing, to me at least. Because the picture style settings are not portable to, other raw processing packages, initially I was tied to Canon's Digital Photo Professional software for my raw conversion. And I didn't really mind this because at the time I thought that that was pretty much the best option as well. I continued to use DPP for rating photos and processing them for a while, but spent then a little time figuring out how to emulate those punchy colors in Adobe Camera Raw, and I used that for quite some time afterwards, until that is, Adobe Lightroom came along. We'll get to that later, but for now, the important thing is that I shoot all of my images in landscape picture style mode as well. You may wonder why I do this if I no longer process my images in Digital Photo Professional, but the main reason is that I'm going to punch up the saturation to a similar level later, and I still want to see the results on the LCD as I shoot. Anyway, the point here is that I always shoot in RAW with Adobe RGB color space and the landscape picture style selected. I take care to get the exposure as close as possible in the field using methods that I've mentioned many times in previous episodes, and I do not shoot sloppily just because I can change exposure or post-processing easily through using RAW. I'm not perfect, of course, and I may still make the wrong decision on exposure from time to time, and I admit that I'll adjust exposure to save an image, to a certain degree, maybe half a stop, maybe even in the extreme, up to one stop, but this is never intentional. Sharpening tools are better now than they used to be, but that's no excuse for sloppy focusing either, or say not using a tripod when it's necessary. I want my images to have the best chance in life as possible, and that means getting it right in the field as much as my skills allow. If I'm going to be out and about for multiple days, I always take a portable storage unit and I back up my cards to a separate hard drive as well, directly from that portable unit. I went into details on this in episode number 75, but basically, I use an Epson P5000 to back up my compact flash cards, and then I put used cards back into the case, but with the back label facing up, so that shows me that the card is used and that I only have one backup of it. Then, when I get back to the car or to the hotel later, I use a second small portable hard drive, which I connect to the P5000 via a USB cable, and then back up the contents to the second hard drive. Once I've done this, I format the CF card. And I put it back into the card case facing upwards this time so that I know that it can be reused. Now I've got two copies of all the shots to that point, so if the hard drive on my P5000 or the backup should die, I've still got a backup in the other device. Once I get home, either with a card or two full of images or my portable device, the next thing is to transfer those images to my computer. I used to use a PC card slot adapter that allowed 32-bit transfer of images, which was way faster than the older adapters that only transferred in 16-bit. Since I built my new PC a few months ago, though, I don't have a PC card slot, so I bought a multi-card interface. It's basically the same size as a floppy disk drive, and it sits in the floppy disk bay, and indeed incorporates a floppy disk drive. But it also has some 15 or so other slots, including a compact flash card slot. So all I have to do is just push the card into the slot on the front of my computer. If I'm copying from my P5000, I just have to plug it into the USB cable and I'm away. Actually, the Epson P5000 also registers its own compact flash slot as a drive on the computer, so you can just sort of put a card directly into that and read cards in via that slot, but I hardly ever use this feature. I didn't want to tie myself down to having to do this as my only option, so now it's really just easier to use the slot that I've put in with the floppy drive if I'm transferring images directly from a card. I'm copying via USB too, so that does make the transfer much faster as well. And I'd say that it's probably comparable to the speeds of my old 32-bit card adapter. Before I start to copy the files, I create a directory for them in my new folder structure. I've changed this since the first podcast on my digital workflow. Since I started to use Adobe Lightroom, I have started to use the year, month, and day hierarchy. That is, now in my hard drive on which I store the images, on the top level, I have a folder for each year that I have images from, which is basically every year since 2000. Then in each of these folders, I have folders for each month, and I don't think there's been a single month in the last 7 years where I haven't shot any images at all. So basically, each year folder contains 12 month folders. Then inside each month folder, I have a day folder with the number of the images, with the number of the day, that the images were shot on. I used to have a system where I could see both the date of the shoot and, the year, month, and day of the shoot and the location in the folder name. Now I embed the location of the shoot into the EXIF data or the metadata when importing into Lightroom. I really don't need that anymore, and it did make drilling down for things a little bit more difficult. So I've kind of switched now, and basically this allows me to just search for shots from the same location by using the keywords. But when I want to look at the images on the hard drive, I know pretty much how long ago it was, so I can start to drill down through the through the dates as well. And I'm getting much more used to using keywords for this now. I'm starting to put keywords for lots of things, but I've not really gone through and keyworded all of my old images yet, because of a limitation of using Lightroom on Vista at the moment, where I can't really just get it to go through all of my old images and reposition them for me. So that's probably going to be, hopefully, in an update at some point in the future. So on the subject of importing into Lightroom, some of you familiar with Lightroom are probably asking why I don't just copy the files during the import and allow Lightroom to create this directory structure for me. Well, this is also a limitation of Vista, but at the moment there's a known issue in that the copying of files to a new location via Lightroom doesn't work, basically. It looks as though it's working and the status bar sort of zips up, but then there's a message flicks up and says that it's not moved any of the images. So hopefully this is going to be fixed in version 1.1, which should be released very soon, I hear. But right now, not being able to copy the files to a different location, it's a known issue, but I'm kind of overriding it manually. Once I've copied the files to my hard disk, I go into Lightroom and I select the import from the library module. And then what I do is I just import them while referencing them at their current location. It's at this point that I select a Lightroom preset to apply to all of the images I'm importing. And then I also basically, you know, what that does is it applies the preset that I spoke about earlier. I've created something called the landscape picture style emulation, and all it does is applies the saturation to all of the images that I'm importing. And you know, I find that this is easier to do when importing, just because it just reduces the steps. There's a pull down there to allow you to select it, and what that does is add 65% saturation on the red, and let's see, that's under the camera calibration section in the development module, and it also adds 18 saturation for the green and blue sliders or channels. I go ahead and select this just straight right off from the start. I'm careful of doing this only in one situation, and that's really when I've shot a number of portraits. If the whole shoot was portraits, which is very rare for me, I think only the only recent time I've done this was a wedding, my niece's wedding in the UK earlier this year. But apart from that, pretty much everything I do, even if it contains a few portraits, I'll just apply this preset and it boosts all of the saturation up to something similar to what I used to get with the landscape picture style from Canon. And you know, and then if there are a few portraits in there, I'll just desaturate them to sort of a normal level later. The other thing that I do is I'll select a metadata preset that embeds my name as the creator and the copyright holder of the image, and a link to my website. And this information, along with other keywords and things, everything that I select in the import dialog, will be embedded into the either the EXIF data or the sidecar XML sidecar files, you know, and then that's there available for me once I view the images in Lightroom. It's not much of a pain, but the other problem with the file moving not working, or the file copying not working on Vista, is that it stops me from using another feature in the copy process, which allows me to rename shots during the import. Until the known issue is fixed, though, it just means that the next step in my workflow is to hit Control A to select all of the images that I've just imported, and then select rename photo from the library menu. Note that in Lightroom, menus change depending on the module that you have selected, and rename photo is only available when you're in the library module. I have a preset created for my file renaming. Again, presets are everything. And this basically adds my initials to the beginning of the file. It actually creates a totally new file name, then an underscore, and then adds the keyword that I have set it up so that I can just type it in while I'm importing. And that's usually sort of the name of the location or something like that. And then another underscore, and then the date of the shoot. That's taken from the EXIF data, and then a four-digit number counter sort of thing to the end of the file. And that starts with 0001. I reset the number of the images, and then that automatically increments one number for each image until it's finished. So I used to maintain the number of the files for each image, but I no longer do this. Basically, now I'm thinking that it's better for me to be able to easily see how many shots I made on that particular day. And that reminds me, if I was to be importing multiple cards for the same day, I'd put them all in the same directory, so that basically I can do this renaming just in one fell swoop. And you can actually do this later at any point, but it just makes it easier to do as many steps advance of this as you can, and just saves extra steps. You'll probably have noticed that I am using a lot of presets, and I'll mention more as we go through this workflow, but I find that anything that has to be done more than once, maybe more than twice, can be made much more efficient by creating a preset. As we'll see as we proceed, you know, pretty much everything has a preset either in Lightroom or an action in Photoshop, so that we can do the same, if we do the same task or process. It's always going to be done in the same way with the same results. Most Lightroom menus contain not just the current presets, pulldowns more so, can contain not just the current presets, but also an option to create a new preset, or if you change the options that of a certain preset after you've read it in or you've loaded it, the menu will also contain an option to update that preset with the current settings. The additional options appear in pull-down menus, but for presets in the main modules, rather than dialogues, you can normally just right-click that preset, and there's an option there to update with current settings, and it will then change that preset by updating it with any of the things that you've changed since you first clicked on it or applied it during the import. And of course, if you want to retain old settings, you'd just create a new preset. So once you have all of the images in Lightroom, the next thing that I start to do then is to rate my images to narrow down the best shots that I will take further in my workflow. This might be a good time to actually answer a question that I've been asked many, many times in email and possibly on the MBP forum as well. I'm often asked what percentage of images are keepers. And my answer to this usually is that if you want to know how many images I take through my workflow and say upload to my website from any one shoot, it's probably around 5%. And this in itself, though, is misleading. This doesn't mean that the other 95% of my work is crap. In the search for better images and the testing of my own techniques and the refining of my artistic vision, I shoot lots of images. If time allows, I'll often shoot the same subject many, many times and from many different angles, with different settings, different depth of field, maybe switching lenses or switching between portrait and landscape. And the truth is that many of the images would still be usable and often quite successful shots, but uploading 60 images of the same flower to my website would not be practical and I'd simply bore everyone to death. If the results warrant, I'll sometimes upload more than one shot of the same subject, but generally I aim to only select one shot of each subject, and that is the one that I find brings my percentage down to around 5%. Because my tastes and requirements for my images will change over time, though, I never delete the remaining images unless they're technically flawed. On occasion, for example, because I shoot in manual mode, I'll see something and I'll just shoot the first frame without changing the settings, and then I'll realize as I'm doing so or straight after when I look at the LCD that because I'm in manual mode, the exposure is way off. I haven't reset the exposure for the new subject, and this will result in an image every so often that is too over or underexposed to be any use. There's also going to be the odd time when I'm pushing things a little bit with regards to slow shutter speeds, where I introduce camera shake, or the subject movement also makes the image unusable. I rate these with a 1 during my first pass, and then I select all the images rated as 1 and delete them before my second pass. But this is pretty much never more than 1 or 2% of the total number of images from any one shoot. So, if you really want to know my keeper ratio, it's probably more like 97-98%. Even when calculating shoots, when I really do sort of push my luck with slow shutter speeds and things. So, what you call a keeper, how you define a keeper ratio may differ from person to person. I remember in the past sort of drilling this down to someone and, hearing, oh, great, that you only get about 5% usable shots. And, this person was pretty pleased that we had a similar keeper ratio. And to be honest, not sort of trying to put that person down, I'm not thinking at all that only 5% of my work is any good. And, I don't know how good the other 95% of his work was, but it just seems strange to be sort of sort of looped in or hooked into that sort of only having 5% good shots on saying a 5% keeper ratio when that's really not the case. So anyway, stop harping on about that. Let's look, continue to look into more detail about how I actually rate my images. Lightroom offers a number of ways to rate images. There are flags that you can use, but I still prefer using the numbers, the 5-star rating system. Now that I do have that 5 stars, more than the 3 in DPP, I find that it gives me much more flexibility when rating, enabling me to rate my images in fewer passes, again saving time. As I just mentioned, in my first pass through, I mark all images that are technically flawed and that I intend to delete with a 1. I've actually improved the efficiency of this process recently thanks to a tip from listener P Squared, real name Phil Peck from Idaho in the USA. Phil heard this on another photography podcast apparently, but was kind enough to pass it on the MBP forum. Basically, when you are in the library module in Lightroom, if you press the shift key and then the number 1 to 5, and for the rating that you want to add to the image, Lightroom will apply that rating and then automatically move to the next image. This means that if you turn caps lock on your keyboard, all you have to do is press the number, and then you don't need to use the shift because effectively that's already on because of caps lock, and it will then move, it will apply that rating and move to the next one. And this is a great tip. It saves not a lot of time, but it just saves more finger work and general sort of hassle. So it's a great tip. Thanks very much to Phil for sharing that. Basically, what I do now is hit that, the caps lock, and then start hitting the rating numbers. Before I do this, actually, I should mention that I also hit shift and tab, and that in Lightroom will get rid of all of the toolbars and the light, the thumbnails, everything. It will maximize the viewing area for photos so that I can see it as large as possible. And then I just start moving through the images, hitting the numbers on the keypad. If I hit 0, it leaves the rating as 0 and moves to the next image. So that's the default if I'm just sort of flicking through images that I'm not selecting. Again, 1 is for deletion. And then I select 3 initially for anything that I like the look of. When I finish this first pass, basically then I'll select everything with a rating of 1 and change the filter so that the filter is visible there on top of the thumbnail bar. But make sure that you select only images that are marked 1 and not 1 and above. If you select 1 and above, then you're also going to delete all of your images that you've just rated as 3. So select everything that's only 1, and then I hit the backspace key to move these to the recycle bin. I now change the filter to show all images rated above 3, and at this point I start a second pass, and I tend to use the arrow keys for this one now rather than the caps lock trick. And the reason for that is really just because now I'm looking at groups of shots where I might have 1 or 2, maybe up to 10, 20 of a similar scene, and I want to be able to move backwards and forwards rather than just forwards, which is what I'd get if I was hitting the 3 and then allowing Lightroom to automatically move forward. I'm just much more likely to go backwards in this sort of second pass. So I'm looking now for subtle differences between similar images that make one better than the other. I'm also thinking of different compositions of the same subject and seeing if I can narrow down my selection anymore. My aim now is just really to get as few images as possible of each subject so that I can really just make this my second to last pass. I tend to hit the number 2 key to demote lesser images. Because Lightroom is currently set to only show images rated 3 or above, this makes the 2 ones disappear from the list, which is good because I really don't need to see them anymore. I also now start to hit the number 4 to promote anything that really stands out, though that's not the main objective of this second pass. You know, really what that does is it gives me the option to just sort of note that for the next pass, and it just helps, you know, helps to speed things along a little, I guess. I don't spend too much time worrying about this in the second pass, though. Once I've gone through the group a second time, more often than not, I'll now have something pretty close to my final selection, but I'll go back to the beginning again and start a third pass. And that quite often will be my final pass. I'll choose the very best images by hitting 4 and adding to that list of 4s. And this way, later on, if I wonder about my selection process, I'll have everything from my first pass marked as 2s, and everything from my second pass, it'll either have been demoted to, you know, to 2, or it'll still be there as a 3. But then my final selection will be marked as 4. And sometimes it's just not possible to narrow down the final list in 3 passes. And what I do is I'll go through again. I'll sometimes use 5 for a fourth or fifth pass, but generally, I'm working with quite a smaller number of images now, so the passes are just much quicker. And when I get to this point, where if I can't figure out which images that I want to use in maybe 4 or 5 passes, and I'm really struggling with it, just because I've got, you know, images that are good, but I can't choose between 1 or 2 of similar sort of subjects, then I'll generally sleep on it. And, you know, unless you're up to a deadline, a hard deadline, leaving the very last call for a day or so can actually really help you to view things in a different way. I find that the emotion attached to photos can often lead us to put something in our selection that will not come across in the image itself. And this emotion, or this emotional response to an image that we have, in my case at least, starts to die off as time passes. And that can enable you to detach yourself from the experience of shooting the image. It just makes things much more objective, really. You can make a much more objective decision about your selection. Anyway, whether it's a smooth rating process or if I take a day or so, take a break and spread it out, whichever way I get to this point, I now have a group of images rated with 4 stars that I am ready to take further in my workflow. We'll cover that in the next episode, though, when we look at what I do next with the images in Photoshop. And I'll be talking first about exporting from Lightroom, and then what I do in Photoshop, and then some I'll touch on printing and, you know, the uploading to the web and stuff like that, and also I'll probably touch on my backup process. Please don't get all excited about the Photoshop stuff. I really don't do a lot with my images in Photoshop, so I wouldn't like you to be too disappointed with just a few steps that I do. But anyway, we'll complete that in part 2 of this multi-part episode. So that's it for this week. I'd like quickly to mention that I've turned on voting for the low perspective assignment. You will have 2 weeks from today to vote for your favorite image until the end of Sunday, June the 24th. The prize for the winner is an original print of your choice, of a photo of your choice, on the paper of your choice and the size that you wish, from my online gallery at martinbaileyphotography.com. Also remember that the votes will be accumulated for a new yearly grand prize that will be awarded in the middle of 2008. This was raised actually in the MBP forum today, but I have to just say here that you guys have really raised the bar on quality and quantity of entries for this assignment. It really has just been amazing to see these the new photos being uploaded and you've created an amazing gallery. If you haven't done so yet, I really recommend that you visit the website www.mbpgalleries.com and take a look at the low perspective assignment. If you are a member, please do vote away. If you're not a member, it takes just a moment to register, and then you'll also be able to vote. And while you're there, sort of take a look at the general content of the site. You'll see some amazing photography and hopefully be inspired to get involved yourself if you're not already an active member. But with that, I'd like to just say thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great week, whatever you do. Bye bye.
Photocastnetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. Photocastnetwork.com.